Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. Bernice Hausman is chair of the Department of Humanities in the Penn State College of Medicine. She's recognized for her research on vaccines and breastfeeding, including why both can be controversial in the United States. She's written several books, most recently, Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy, which was published last year. Bernice Hausman, thank you for joining us on WPSU.
I'm happy to be here.
You argue that we should not dismiss people who are skeptical of vaccines as just, quote, crazy. Why not?
Because it doesn't help pretty much anything. The people who dissent from vaccination have a variety of reasons for doing so. And anybody who's interested in public health should be more interested in the why than just in dismissing people.
Isn't one of the concerns, though, that with measles, for example, if enough people don't get their children vaccinated, that you're putting other children who can't get vaccinated for one reason or another, they're being put at risk?
Certainly, if the communities don't have high vaccination levels, then they're more susceptible to outbreaks of any communicable disease. So yes, that's true at some level. But we also live in a country where people have freedoms and liberties that are enshrined in the Constitution. So one question becomes then, what's the best mechanism to ensure high levels of vaccination, which lead to herd immunity? And so that's really the question at heart. One of the questions at the heart of vaccination controversy is whether or not there should be mandates and laws that force people to be vaccinated when they don't believe it's in their best interest to do so, or whether there should be other measures. So those are some of the issues that I explore in the book. And part of the reframing that I try to do is not to answer questions about whether or not people should be vaccinated or not, or whether or not this is going to endanger people, but to look at why we have the controversy today and what are some of the ways in which we can understand better people's different positions within it.
And what did you find when you're doing the research in the book? Why do we have these controversies?
Well, we have controversies because we have different views about the role of illness in human life. We have different views about whether or not the state should have the authority to tell people what to do with their bodies, which of course is a huge issue right now during the coronavirus pandemic, where we have a lot of state power being used to enforce the stay-at-home rules and things. And so it will be very interesting to see if people's views about state power and public health change during the course of this pandemic. So there are also concerns in vaccine dissent that are concerns that people who don't dissent from vaccines also hold. So concerns about the role of pharmaceutical companies in developing and marketing medicines, concerns about whether or not the government is too lenient towards pharmaceutical companies and doesn't provide enough regulation and assurance that the products that they make are safe, concerns about the profits that pharmaceutical companies make from vaccines and other medications and whether or not there are too many vaccines that are being promulgated for our own good. So there are a lot of themes and concerns in contemporary culture that sort of flow through vaccination dissent that are important to other people who do actually accept vaccines.
If there are concerns, does it risk legitimizing them? If you start talking about them and listening to them, does that risk giving them credibility?
So again, I'm going to reframe that because I think that suggesting that some concerns are legitimate and some concerns are illegitimate is a way of falsely dividing up the situation and suggesting that we already know what concerns are legitimate and therefore we're going to dismiss people who have concerns that they deeply feel and we're just going to say that's irrational and therefore not appropriate. Let me give you a historical example. In the 1990s, the news reporting on vaccination concerns was very sympathetic to parents who had concerns about thimerosal, which is a ethyl mercury preservative used in vaccines for decades to maintain their purity. After the 2000s, and especially after 2005 or so, there was a significant shift where news reporting was no longer sympathetic to parents who had concerns about vaccines, especially concerns about thimerosal. And partly that was due to studies from the Institute of Medicine that demonstrated there had been no concrete evidence demonstrating a risk to children from thimerosal in vaccines, even though thimerosal was removed from most vaccines by the FDA in 1999 as a sort of precautionary measure. But what's interesting then is that overall there is just a lot less sympathy for people who have concerns about vaccines, even though concerns about contamination and vaccines have been longstanding ever since the smallpox vaccine was invented in the late 18th century. So you have a social context in which it becomes impossible to produce what you would call a legitimate concern about vaccines, even though many parents who actually accept vaccines for their children have concerns, for example, about the number of vaccines that their children get when they're infants and young children. So the way that I would reframe that is not a question around credibility and legitimacy, but a question around how do we understand and proactively address the concerns of many people about the things we do to our bodies to prevent disease that we are afraid actually make us more vulnerable.
You also write about the squeaky wheels. You say don't pay too much attention to the squeaky wheels. How do you differentiate between a squeaky wheel and maybe what's a quieter concern from someone you call vaccine hesitant?
I try to talk about the very ideologically committed vaccine dissenting community. And those are people who are really, really against vaccines, against the idea of vaccines, and use scientific argumentation and publish scientific studies to try to demonstrate the dangers of vaccines and the concerns about mandating vaccines that are dangerous. So that in this country, in the United States, the concern emerges in an argument about the dangers of vaccines, but it's linked to the fact of vaccine mandates. Because, you know, if you believed that vaccines were a threat to your health, but they weren't mandated, your political activity would be much less significant because you could get out of it. You wouldn't have to vaccinate. It's the linkage between these two that is so important and creates this really powerful political group, even though they're very small. And then there's a whole group of people who have a variety of kinds of concerns about vaccines, but are not ideologically committed to the dangers of vaccines, but have concerns. And a lot of those concerns emerge when parents understand how many vaccines their children get at a single doctor's visit. And those concerns can also sort of be animated by concerns about the ingredients in vaccines, that not all physicians are well educated about how to talk to parents about the ingredients in vaccines. And so any kind of hesitation on the part of their healthcare provider in responding to questions becomes kind of a fodder for increasing concerns. And in addition, we really have a healthcare system that is not oriented towards lengthy conversations about healthcare concerns because those are expensive. And so, because time is expensive. And so I think that you also have the added stress of physicians feeling like they don't actually have time to address the concerns of parents and then wanting to dismiss them as not significant because they feel that they don't have any scientific basis. And then parents have concerns that they want to have their care providers address seriously and feel frustrated because they feel like there's no time to do that. And so you have this other level of sort of emotional entanglement because both sides are frustrated that they can't do what they really want to do, which is just sit down and talk about their concerns.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's not new. You talk about the historical precedent for it, but I wondered, is it more exaggerated today, or is there more of it just because of the abundance of information out there online? You can really find information to match your viewpoint regardless of what it is.
So it's hard for me to say that that's not true. And yet, if you look historically, elites have always worried about the information that is available to the masses whenever there's a technological development that creates the new availability of information. So when the Gutenberg press was invented, there was all this concern about how the masses would now learn to read and they would have access to information that they didn't have before. In the 19th century, there was a huge concern when paperback books started to be published, the penny dreadfuls, and how the masses would have too much, you know, people shouldn't read novels because they're bad for them. They animate their imagination in dangerous ways. every time there's a technological development that allows large numbers of people to have access to more information, there's this perception that the elites can't control that access. And so I worry that our current concern about how the internet makes all this information indiscriminately available is a problem because people are misinformed. I'm not denying the fact that there's misinformation out there, but I do have a tendency to sort of think, well, this is just another way for people who think they know the truth to suggest that other people should have less access to information that they are interested in. Yeah, they can't handle it. So I'm really wary of that argument. My research group did a study of regional newspapers around the United States from 1915 to 1922. The Library of Congress has a database called Chronicling America that has digitized regional newspapers from the 1800s through 1922. And so we did a study of 14 newspapers from around the country and looked for vaccination concerns as they emerged in these newspapers during that time period. And what we found were themes that were remarkably similar to themes that we see today. So concerns about physician and pharmaceutical greed in making vaccines that then brought business to certain doctors, right? And sort of thinking that, you know, doctors were trying to just make money off of vaccines. We saw people concerned about contaminants in vaccines. We saw that there were concerns that vaccines could make people sick. So that suggests to me that these same concerns are, in fact, remarkably historically consistent.
You also said that you've gotten criticized for trying to be neutral, and you wrote an op-ed piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer. We could do the hard work of understanding other people's views rather than pigeonholing them in convenient categories. And you said you got a lot of really nasty emails and comments about that. Is that right?
What I learned is if you publish an op-ed, you can never read the comments. Right. I mean, there were some positive comments, like thank you for like not writing an inflammatory op-ed against anti-vaxxers. But most of the comments were, you know, on the order of like, how could you be so stupid? And, you know, it's interesting because I just talked to a woman yesterday who was writing an article about a call out culture. And so she called me because she thought I would have some things to say to her about this problem in sort of young adult culture about people who are afraid that they're so afraid to do things publicly because they're afraid somehow they'll do something wrong and then somebody will call them out, take a picture, post it online, and then that's it. It's there forever. And they're sort of somehow canceled or called out as being politically incorrect. And it was a fascinating conversation because I realized that's really the epitome of what I've been talking about. Like, if there's a lot of people who do things that I don't understand and that I think are stupid, and yet if all I do is publicly say, well, that's stupid, I know that that's wrong and you should not do that, and not try to understand why the other person does this thing or what their thought process was and try to produce some empathy, all I do is contribute to the current polarization in society that we see right now. It is really hard to do the work of not making a kind of evaluative commentary about other people's behavior, but actually trying to understand why people do the things they do and what their thought processes are, and then try to make some connection across that divide. That is really hard. And yet, I think that the point we're at now in terms of vaccine controversy, that's where we all need to be. I don't know that that's always where we need to be, in the sense that in a less polarized context, maybe there's another way to approach this problem. But one of the things my research group did was demonstrate the increasingly inflammatory news reporting on this topic. You get to a point where in reputable sources of the news, like the New York Times, you get highly inflammatory reporting on vaccination controversy. And it's odd, right, that would be the case. So there was an article that was published, I'm going to quote you from, this was published in 2015 in the New York Times. Earlier this month, a bill surfaced in the New York State legislature proposing that parents be permitted to reject vaccinations for their children simply because they opposed them philosophically, as one might oppose Oreos or the Disney Channel. It's treating as if it's like, you know, like as if philosophical objections. I mean, the reason why we have philosophical objections in many states to vaccination, and of course that no longer exists in New York State. They passed a law after the measles cases last year. But the reason why we have philosophical exemption to vaccination is because in this country, in many states, the belief was you couldn't just have a religious exemption. You had to actually have a philosophical or personal belief exemption for those people whose belief systems are not codified in an organized religion. That's a pretty core American tenet, I think.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. We're talking with Bernice Hausman, chair of the Department of Humanities in the Penn State College of Medicine. Hausman's most recent book is Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy, which was published last year. So when your book was published, you had no way, unless you could see the future, of knowing what the situation we would be in right now. Of course, you were scheduled to come talk at Penn State University Park, and that's not possible right now. We have to have a telephone conversation. We're all practicing social distancing. Do you expect there to be a similar sentiment? Are you seeing that developing, the pushback on the government trying to restrict and regulate people's behavior as a way of dealing with COVID-19, the same way that there's pushback when trying to deal with other health pandemics?
So it's really interesting because I was scheduled to give 3 talks this spring on measles, like the measles outbreaks last year, and those all got canceled. And the measles outbreaks last year looked like peanuts compared to what we're looking at now, right? Like nobody in this country died as a result of the measles outbreaks last year. 1,200 and some odd people got sick with measles. And that was a huge deal last year. And now we're like, it feels like that was like nothing. I will say there's global concern about the stoppage or the halting of various immunization campaigns, and they are actually extremely concerned about a resurgence of measles, given the fact that they can't conduct those vaccination campaigns right now. So that's a sort of a separate story from what you asked me. So there have started to become these demonstrations or efforts to resist the state efforts to shut down society, basically. So in Michigan recently, they had a really big demonstration. And on places like Twitter, people are talking about this like they're just like the anti-vaxxers, these science denialists. I actually don't think that what's going on is science denial. I think it's a social resistance to the very extreme measures that are being taken. I do think that people in the vaccine dissent communities, the really ideological vaccine dissenters, are very concerned about the extent of state power that is being used to control what people do with their bodies right now. And I think they're afraid that that's going to extend into more legislation to force vaccination. So that's one set of concerns that I see bubbling up in that particular community. I also think that there are concerns about what's going to happen when the vaccine for coronavirus is developed. I think that's what makes this particular pandemic, for example, really different from the Spanish flu, which was 102 years ago. People made vaccines at the time. It was at sort of the beginning of bacteriology and vaccine success, but because they couldn't see the virus and they couldn't determine what they were working with, all the vaccines that were made during the Spanish flu period were against the bacteria that created a secondary infection, and they were marginally, if at all, you know, effective. So we're dealing now with a situation in which we, I think, can feel that there will be a vaccine within a year to 18 months to 2 years. And then the fear is that there are going to be requirements to get that vaccine, or requirements to be you have to demonstrate a positive antibody test or be vaccinated to be in public in certain ways. And so I think that's an emerging fear in the vaccine dissenting communities. But there is also something I'm tracking, which is in vaccine development, there's a group at University of Pittsburgh that has a prototype vaccine for coronavirus that is not a shot. It's a patch. in which the vaccine is delivered to through the skin through sort of these tiny little needles that are in the patch. So you put the patch on for a couple of days and gradually those little needles, they go into your skin and then the material, the vaccine in them dissolves. That kind of vaccine could be a game changer in the way that vaccine descent is experienced in this country.
Why?
Well, first of all, if you asked before about the vaccine hesitant, people who are vaccine hesitant, and a big portion of those people are just kind of really can't stand bringing their children into the doctor's office and having them get like four shots in one day when they're like 4 months old, right? So what if you're a parent and you take your kid in to be vaccinated and the doctor gives you four patches and said, okay, over the next 2 weeks, I want you to give like this patch first and then gradually, you know, like that's on for 48 hours and then I want you to do the next one. So parents would be much more in control and they would be able to trace whether or not their child had a negative reaction to one vaccine.
Interesting. So it might alleviate some of their concerns. Could it also, though, open up a new problem of people only delivering part of the vaccine?
Yeah, it could. It could, right? So you could, it's a situation in which you're definitely, by giving over more power to parents, you're sort of like not able to be in as much control. But I think that, like, if this mechanism for vaccine delivery is successful, you'll see those concerns discussed in public health. Let me put it this way. There was a huge concern during the HIV AIDS pandemic is ongoing. But in the earlier years, when they first started to have medications that controlled HIV in the 1990s, and they were rolling them out, there was this huge concern that like people in Africa wouldn't comply with the strict drug regimens that they had to. And it turned out, at least in one study that I read, that people in Africa who were taking HIV drugs were actually better at compliance than people in the United States. So we have a lot of preconceived notions of who's gonna actually comply with medical advice and not. And I think that this is a case where we would want to like see what happened.
I want to go back to that idea too of the stay-at-home orders, and there's pushback on that because some people are saying, well, I'm in a part of Pennsylvania. This is hypothetical. I might be in a part of Pennsylvania where there's only a couple cases. Why do I have to stay at home? You're, you know, ruining businesses, hurting people's lives. And there's a lot of pushback on that. And the government's saying this is for everyone's good over the long term. How do you think those conversations should happen in a productive way that people don't get pigeonholed?
Well, so one of the problems is for us in this particular conversation in the United States is that we have what we are seeing is that we actually have a really fragile social safety net. And in other, as I understand it, other countries that have stronger social safety nets and stronger healthcare provision that is governmentally provided, while they are certainly experiencing economic hardships, they aren't experiencing it as much as this country. So part of the problem we have is that the state is telling people to stay home and not work, and yet there's not a lot of support or not enough support for what happens to people when the state forces them to do that. And so this problem between upholding the public health and being attentive to the economic consequences is the age-old public health problem of pandemics. So I'm teaching a course right now to students on pandemics, and we just did earlier this week, we studied cholera pandemics in the 19th century in the United States. And so in 1832, when cholera first came to this country, the conversation among the public health folks and the government in New York City was exactly the same. If we recognize that cholera is here and we shut down the city, the economic consequences are going to be so severe that we're not sure that people will comply. That's the same conversation we're having today. And that was in 1832.
What are the lessons or takeaways from that, do you think?
Well, my takeaway would be that the public health infrastructure that we need for good times is not enough for what we need for pandemic times, and that this country needs to stop being short-sighted about what public health needs in order to flourish and to protect protect society. And so, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when we sort of shifted from the great society views of the 1960s that leached into the 1970s about the government protecting people and providing a social safety net and providing job training and jobs for people who needed them, to the sort of austerity and small government model that started during the Reagan administration. So what we see is a country that has continually over the last four decades told people that they would flourish if the government took in less of their money and they had more of it to spend themselves. And so then the government doesn't have the capacity to handle crises like this one. And my hope is that we see this as a governmental problem and not just a problem of medicine and health, and that public health is in fact a responsibility of the government, and that fully funding public health means not just funding it for good times, but funding it for pandemic times.
Are you planning on any other research or studies related to public perceptions of COVID-19? Are you getting ideas?
I'm part of a group of faculty, three of whom are up at Penn State main campus and State College. We're putting together a website called Viral Imaginations COVID-19, and we're soliciting creative expression from Pennsylvanians about their experience of the pandemic. So creative writing and visual art. That website is going to go live any day now. And we're really excited about that because we're going to create an online gallery, which will then also be an archive to study about people's experiences in Pennsylvania of the pandemic. So one of the things that's happened in my job is that all of the medical students have been taken out of the clinic. So I'm teaching a course right now on pandemics to 52 fourth year medical students. And it's really been really interesting, but it's been taken up all my time. So it's hard for me to imagine right now, like what my research will look like. But in about a few weeks, I'll be finished with the course, and then I'll be able to sort of think about what am I going to be paying attention to. And I think right now, at least, what I would say is that I'm thinking that the kind of tacking back and forth between history and today, and thinking about the Spanish flu and what that meant historically, globally, and also in this country, and then thinking about what we learned, but also the fact that we are still wearing masks and social distancing, which were the same preventive measures that were in place in 1918, is a fascinating thing given how significantly medicine has advanced. And yet the primary public health preventive measures are exactly the same.
Bernice Hausman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a great conversation.
We've been talking with Bernice Hausman, chair of the Department of Humanities in the Penn State College of Medicine and author of Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. To listen to this and other episodes of Take Note, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.